Speak up.
You're listening to Speak Up on CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby. We're the campus and community radio station at Simon Fraser University, where we broadcast from unceded Coast Salish territories.
Good morning and welcome to Speak Up for Monday, April 6, 2026. Thank you for joining us on the program today. My name is Magnus Tewald. I'm your host for this hour. We got a great show lined up for you today. We have the municipal elections are starting to heat up. They don't come actually until November, but candidates are starting to declare or drop out and slates are falling into place. Lots to follow on that. We have a report on New West Mayor Patrick Johnson today, who's running again. We also have a report on the Vancouver Public Library's new Indigenous Storyteller in Residence, and a profile on fire ecologist Kira Hoffman, who's recently been honored by the National Geographic. In Nanaimo, we have a report coming from Nanaimo. We have a report about how new street banners in the city are going to be produced by one of the city's youngest artists. We also have, of course, Gardening with Embark, and Peter R.H. will be here with his commentary at the end of the show. It's a beautiful day out there today, maybe a little cloud, but once you finish listening to this program, I hope you'll get out and enjoy some sunshine. Okay, here we are with Danny Nesvadarani's report on how things are shaping up in
reporting from New Westminster, BC, this is Danny Nesvadarani, your community journalist for CJSF 90.1 FM. On March 31st, New Westminster Mayor Patrick Johnstone announced that he will be seeking re-election in the city's upcoming municipal election later this year in October. The announcement took place inside Pizzeria Ludica, a local pizza restaurant in New Westminster. And shortly after doors opened, the restaurant was packed with fellow city staff, councillors, and supporters of Mayor Johnstone and Community First New Westminster, the municipal political party the Mayor Johnstone is a part of. CJSF attended the event, and before the official announcement, we spoke with Mayor Johnstone about his plans to run for a second term as Mayor of New Westminster. The first question we asked is, why are you running for mayor?
Because I love the city. I'm really proud of the work that we've done in the last 3.5-4 years in the city, and I recognize that we've got a lot more work to do. So I think that we've got a great team, and we're creating great momentum in New Westminster, and I want to keep that momentum moving.
We then asked Mayor Johnstone if he has plans to change the way things are currently being governed in City Hall if elected once again in October.
I think the biggest thing is we are on a great momentum right now, and we want to keep on moving it forward. We're doing great work on affordable housing in this city. We've got 3 affordable housing projects under construction right now. We've done so much work on renter protections and doing that kind of work to deal with affordable housing. Yet we still have seniors afraid about being able to age in place. We still have young families who can't get that extra bedroom when they have another kid. We've got people living on the street in New Westminster, so we have more work to do on that front. I'm really excited about the next phase in recreation investments in the city and parks and recreation spaces. We just introduced our new parks and recreation plan, and we can now start building some of those facilities. Excited about that work. I'm excited about a Vision Zero work and making our roads safer. I'm excited about our momentum on climate action and youth empowerment in the city. There's a lot of good things going on in this city, but we just need to keep moving forward.
Since becoming mayor in 2022, Johnstone and the councillors affiliated with Community First New Westminster have held a majority on council, with city councillors Daniel Fontaine and Paul Minhas representing the New West Progressives, a party that is often in public opposition with Community First. Councillor Fontaine, who is regularly debated with Mayor Johnstone over council decisions, has also announced that he will be running for mayor at the end of this year. And we asked Mayor Johnstone if that has had any effect on the council's dynamic or governance leading up to the next municipal election.
I mean, there's a lot of debate in council, and there's a lot of spirited debate on council, but ultimately, we're still getting the work done. I'm glad that we have a majority of people on council who vote for affordable housing, who vote for climate action, who vote for our great approach to community engagement. We've got a lot of positive work going on at council, and the majority of council is voting for it, and that's important. Debate's important. It's important to make sure that we're checking on the work that we're doing and checking with the community all the time on the work we're doing. But we don't want to let it stop our momentum.
After a row of speakers from community members to city councilors, Johnson went up last and gave the official announcement that he'll be running for mayor for a second term in New Westminster. This has been Danny Nezvedarani, your community journalist for CJSF 90.1 FM. This segment would not have been possible without the continued support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada's Local Journalism Initiative. You can also find this piece on frequencynews.ca. Reporting from Vancouver, BC, this is Danny Nezvedarani, your community journalist for CJSF 90.1 FM. The beginning of March this year, the Vancouver Public Library announced its 2026 Indigenous Storyteller in Residence, Nishka Theatre Artist C. Peel. VPL's Indigenous Storyteller in Residence program was first developed in 2008 to highlight the importance of storytelling as a way to learn about and from Indigenous communities throughout Vancouver. C. Peel is an actor, director, writer, dancer, and producer who has worked in various art spaces throughout BC, including his work as the Indigenous Outreach Coordinator at the Kulch and his work as the Artistic Associate at the Carmen Arts Group. CJSF reached out to C. Peel to learn more about what he's working on for this residency, and during our conversation, we discuss some of what he hopes he's able to achieve as VPL's Indigenous Storyteller in Residence. In his own words, he hopes to destabilize the notion that people understand what Indigenous means.
It's already tricky enough to land opportunities as an Indigenous person, and it's tricky to find opportunities that allow for the dignified self-agency to determine what exactly the position can mean. It's tricky to find opportunities like that, meaning that a lot of opportunities will sort of have an often subconscious assumption of what indigeneity is, and that can sort of set the stage for a potential limiting on what the true possibilities are for Indigenous people to create art and to self-express, because there's this potential for the understanding to impair who gets selected, because you don't necessarily fit the understanding of what indigeneity is as opposed to what it can be.
This sentiment from C. Peel is something that can be seen throughout all of the programming and personal projects that he's working on during his time as the Indigenous Storyteller in Residence for the VPL. Specifically, one of the events that he is hosting is titled Pretendianism. Pretendianism is the term that has been given to a social phenomenon in which someone has publicly and falsely claimed Indigenous identity, often for some form of personal gain. And we asked him why it was important for him to tackle that subject in particular.
What is our understanding of the word going into the conversation before we even start the conversation around indigeneity, pretendianism, opportunity? All of these big, enormous conversations, before we even get there, can we just sit with the curiosity towards what our current understanding is? Because to not do so sets the stage for the continuing reoccurrence of the phenomena. Not that it's going to stop the phenomena, but if we can carry an open-ended curiosity around why does this thing keep happening? I mean, we've got clear reasons, like I mentioned, it's the opportunity, it's the money, it's the acclaim, all of these benefits that can go along with landing a position in a prestigious organization, like not specifically that this has happened, but like a position like what you might find as the Indigenous Storyteller in Residence at the Vancouver Public Library, where it's well-funded, got access to the public, it's got access to all of this other stuff. I feel like it's so vitally important to not leave anything unsaid when it comes to these conversations, because it's not enough to just have a position available It's also important in the conversation of decolonialism and reindigenization and cultural evolution to be willing to sit with the discomfort that can come from a potential misstep in, oh, this institution hired somebody and it turns out they're not indigenous. I think that a part of the journey needs to be, well, no, let's just unpack that. Let's talk this through. And before we even get to the point where it actually occurs, before we even get to that point, can we just sit down and talk about what this actually is?
One of the last things we spoke about with C. Peel was the personal project he's developing as part of his role as the Indigenous Storyteller in Residence. He gave us an in-depth overview of the project, explaining how it relates to many of the other questions that he is posing throughout this residency.
So a question that I've been sitting with that is at the heart of my personal project here at VPL, as well as it had been at the heart of a different project, so I'm looking to figure out how does the question manifest in a different form. But the question is, what comes to your mind when I say the word Indigenous? And how did that get there? How did that understanding get there in the first place? What set the stage for that understanding? The first iteration of the project was a dance theater piece that I developed in a residency with Raven Spirit Dance. They are an Indigenous dance company here in Vancouver. I spent about a year in a developmental residency where I worked alongside a mentor to work on a personal project. And that was 2024. I worked with Yvette Nolan, an Indigenous artist, fantastic, outstanding artist, really, really insightful. And in one of our conversations about the project and about the nature of it, she had said something that ended up becoming the title of that version of the piece, which was that a lot of the things that I'm sort of sitting with and unpacking with as an Indigenous person, these are the things that I cannot unknow. And so that became the title, The Things I Cannot Unknow.
To learn more about C. Peel's work and some of the events that are going to be hosted during his time as the Indigenous Storyteller in Residence at the Vancouver Public Library, you can go to vpl.ca/storyteller. This has been Danny Nesvedarani, your community journalist for CJSF 90.1 FM. This segment would not have been possible without the continued support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada's Local Journalism Initiative. You can find this piece on frequencynews.ca. You can also find our full-length interview with C. Peel on cjsf.ca.
This is Bird Note. One of the biggest threats to birds is the decline in biodiversity due to habitat loss. And the traditional manicured lawn isn't helping. Even birds who visit backyard feeders, like these black-capped chickadees, need a healthy mix of seeds, berries, and insects, often found on the native plants that we villainize as weeds when they grow in our lawns, says ecologist Douglas Tallamy.
We have more than 40 million acres of lawn in the U.S., which is the size of New England, and that's an ecological deadscape.
That means one of the easiest ways to protect birds at home is to grow native plants, says Tallamy, who co-founded an organization called Homegrown National Park to help people transform their lawns into havens for wildlife.
I'd love people to stop looking at their yard as an isolated ecosystem. It's part of a neighborhood, and somebody's got a sunny spot down the street but no trees. Okay, that's where the pollinator gardens go. Somebody's got a giant oak and is overspreading two or three yards. That's great. That's going to provide a lot of resources for many of the houses in that yard. So look at your neighborhood as an entire local ecosystem and see what the total resources are.
Reducing your lawn to make room for native plants is a small step forward.
But imagine if everybody did this. This is why we call the Homegrown National Park movement a grassroots movement. It's a call to action.
To learn more about Homegrown National Park, start at our website, birdnote.org. I'm Ariana Remmel.
The annual Sled Island Music and Arts Festival is back June 17th to 21st, presented by Service Credit Union. Experience 5 days of music, comedy, art, and much more in diverse venues across Calgary, Alberta. Joining Sled Island's previously announced guest curator, Clipping, is English Chamber Folk Ensemble, Black Country New Road, revered Canadian pop project Homeshake, renowned abstract rapper Billy Woods, LA synth punks Sextile, fuzzy indie rock outfit Feeble Little Horse, outlandish egg punk group Snooper, lo-fi post-punk duo Sweeping Promises, New York City-based ambient pioneer Laraji, genre-bending dream pop artist Salami Rose Joe Lewis, and many more. Plus, there are over 150 more artists still to be announced. Check out the current lineup and get your passes and tickets at sledisland.com.
Are you a fan of industrial and have been trying to find smaller artists? Have you only heard of Nine Inch Nails and are looking to get further into the genre? Maybe you're like that guy I met in my lecture who hadn't even heard of Linkin Park. No matter where you're coming from, Wire & Nerve is the show for you. 1 hour of all kinds of industrial, from Throbbing Gristle to Godflesh to Frontline Assembly and more. Tune in Mondays 7 to 8 p.m. only on CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby.
Time for the weather. Looks like we're going to have a pretty good week here in the Vancouver region. Sun is going to be the story through most of the week until Friday, with temperatures up into the high teens towards the end of the week. Lows overnight down to 3, a little warmer later in the week. Great for your gardening. Beautiful weather, lots of sun for your plants, and nice weather to get out into the garden with. Things are going to take a little turn towards the end of the week, with clouds coming in on Friday night and a mix of showers and cloud seemingly throughout the rest of the weekend. Hopefully we'll see a bit of change in that. But for this week anyway, nice weather. Get some of your light clothing out and get out in the sunshine.
This is CICK News. Each year, National Geographic highlights a group of people it believes are shaping the future. Scientists, activists, artists, and storytellers tackling some of the most urgent challenges of our time. Launched in 2025, the National Geographic 33 is a global recognition of 33 individuals working at the front lines of issues like climate change, biodiversity loss, and social equity. Inspired by the organization's original 33 founders, the initiative celebrates people who aren't just studying problems, but are actively working toward solutions in their communities and around the world. This year, one of those honorees comes from Northern BC. Dr. Kira Hoffman, a fire ecologist from Smithers, has been named a 2026 National Geographic 33 honoree for her work alongside Indigenous communities to reintroduce cultural burning, a practice that not only restores ecosystems, but could play a critical role in reducing the severity of modern wildfires. Her work is part of a growing global shift in how we understand fire, not just as a threat, but as a tool for renewal and resilience. I spoke with Dr. Hoffman about what this recognition means and about the work happening right here in Northern BC that's gaining this international attention.
My name is Kira Hoffman, and I'm a fire ecologist, and I work at the University of British Columbia in the Center for Wildfire Coexistence and also at the Bulkley Valley Research Center in Smithers. I feel incredibly honored and humbled and excited to be recognized, as well as the three nation partners that I work with here in the Northwest. I just feel grateful for National Geographic for supporting my work. I've been a grantee since about 2018. I got my first National Geographic grant, and they've really been wonderful at supporting the work. So I was named individually, but they really talked about my collaborative work and how that makes my fire ecology work possible. So with the Chisalata Carrier Nation at the Office of the Wet'suwet'en and the Gitignau Nation as well. So those three partners have really supported my work, and in turn, I've supported capacity building with training and the ability to make cultural burns to bring the story of how critically important they are for this ecosystem and the people who live here more broadly.
Do you think that that also just helps bring more awareness to cultural fire, prescribed burns, natural forests?
Yeah, it definitely does. It's a very critical practice that's happened here for millennia. And I think it's really important that the public is more aware of the benefits of fire, not just cultural fire, but also natural lightning fire as well, because we live in these fire adapted ecosystems. So the big thing that's missing from many of the places we live is fire. We just have been excluding it for a long time. But that's changing. And I think the story of fire is one that's very, like, it's deeply human. So I think in many ways we can all connect to our feelings around fire. Like, we usually feel really good when we're sitting around a campfire. We usually feel really bad when we see the devastating impacts of wildfire that we become more used to. So yeah, my work, and this is why it's part of the change makers. They came together to kind of think how they could support the globe, how they could be change makers. And so this annual award recognizes people who are pushing kind of the envelope in their fields. It's a very cool opportunity to be a fire ecologist in a rural community in Canada and be recognized among people that I very much so admire.
How does this award actually translate to affecting your work? Do you feel like this opens doors or kind of brings any more attention to your work and even maybe even the area of Northern BC to the world?
Yeah, I think it does. I think that people are really looking for ways to connect with nature and ways to connect more with ecosystems. And this is just one of those stories that allows people to see the benefits to, again, like a disaster, essentially, that we become really used to. So I think it does alert people to the fact that there's really good positive things going on, and that there's many people who are thinking about climate change. There's many people who are thinking about the well-being of ecosystems and human health. It's a great reminder of the good work that's going on. My focus is still the same. It's about really producing the science so that we can understand more about how plants interact with fire. And so I am trying to understand more about some of the genetic side of plant communities that have always evolved with fires, like how our landscapes evolved with fire. And some of the issues that we're seeing right now because they're not able to absorb fire any longer. So I'm thinking about that in a social sense, but also a biophysical sense. I'm just about to go into burn season, and that usually lasts about 6 weeks or so. I'm always up for, you know, sharing work and hopefully do that again soon.
Here. Is there an actual physical award that you have?
It is not a physical award, but yeah.
Was there anything else that you wanted to just let people know, either about what you're working on?
Just that, you know, we are continuing to support cultural fire in this area. We have a few burns planned with some of the nation partners, and it's an opportunity for the public to just become more aware of some of these practices. And so if you hear about them, you know, you might have people that say that's a lot of work for a fire, or we don't want to see smoke in the community. I think it's just really important to educate yourself on, learn about this incredible cultural practice.
Thanks so much for taking the time to speak with me about this today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
CSK News is funded by the Government of Canada, the Community Radio Fund of Canada, and is a participating station in the Local Journalism Initiative. On behalf of my colleague Dan Messick and myself, Pam Hassan, thanks for listening.
This is a C2R News update. In the face of a global biological crisis, a Vancouver Island research group is using new environmental DNA techniques to help better understand some of the coast's smallest fish. Project Watershed, located out of the Comox Valley, has been monitoring surfsmelt and Pacific sand lance, two different species of forage fish found around the coast of Vancouver Island. While these fish may be small and less desirable for humans to eat, these fish are valuable parts of the ocean ecosystem, as they are food for some of the ocean's top predators. In monitoring the population of forage fish along the Salish Sea, Project Watershed joined a team of researchers at the University of Victoria to find new methods for collecting environmental DNA. Jacqueline Huard, forage fish project lead at Project Watershed, says environmental DNA, or eDNA, is DNA collected not directly from an animal, but from environmental samples such as soil, water, air, and snow.
So as any animal, but especially fish that we're focused on, as they move through their environment, they're constantly sloughing off and like shedding bits of DNA. So it could be from hair, or in the case of fish, it'd be like scales or slime, or especially when they're spawning and they're dropping eggs or sperm into the environment, like it's just full of DNA. And so we can go around and pick up water or sand and then look for traces of DNA in that sample.
For the last 8 years, Project Watershed has been using eDNA to detect tiny traces of genetic materials fish leave behind on the sand at beaches.
And so right now, when we go to a beach, usually we collect about a cup of sand from each beach, which is like made up of many tiny little scoops, you know, like 30 to 100 little scoops across the beach of sand. And then we take that sand, we put it in the freezer, and we get it down to her lab, or right now when we're using many, many samples, we send it to another lab all the way in Guelph. And then they look in that sand for DNA of sand lance and surf smelt.
They have been sampling beaches around Vancouver Island to collect and monitor the eDNA left by the forage fish. One small hurdle in research occurred when some local First Nations did not want materials removed from their territories due to cultural significance or a site being sacred. This included sand from beaches. Temporarily, eDNA monitoring was halted until a culturally respective solution could be found. From this, Project Watershed worked with the forage fish researchers at the University of Victoria and developed a new collection method called the floppy dip.
It's like a special piece of paper. It's like the size of a toonie, and it's charged, and so it can grab DNA. And so what we do is we go along the beach, we collect the sand as if we normally would. We put it in a Ziploc bag, very high-tech tools, and then we add some regular drinking water that would have no chance of having come across their DNA before. So we add that in, we add in that special piece of paper, and we shake it around. You shake it around for a minute. I like to think of it as our shake and bake technique. And then we take that piece of paper out, and we add it to like a little envelope with some silica packs and we send that to the lab instead of the sand, and the sand can get put back on the beach immediately. We don't have to take it away from the beach at all.
Huard says while different species of forage fish can be found around the world, with some countries heavily researching the fish or even commercially fishing them, there is still a lot of unknowns.